Canucks Central Wednesday. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. We are a presentation of your local Grip Auto and Tire location. Friendly service and expert advice are waiting for you at gripauto.ca today. Lots to come on the program. We're going to talk to Daniel Nugent-Bowman coming up after 3:30. Oilers have their head coach of the future and very interesting offseason ahead. We're going to start going through each Pacific Division team and what their offseasons may look like. Our goalie guru, Kevin Woodley, will join us after 5 o'clock. So yesterday was June 21st, Sat.
Yeah.
The official start of summer.
Yeah.
And it finally actually feels like summer.
It does.
In Vancouver.
And I don't know if it's us being conditioned to handle the weather the way it's been, the mild temperatures.
January weather.
But 20 degrees, I feel like that Montreal Canadiens fan.
Yes.
Like, 20 degrees feels like 35 degrees. That's kind of how I feel today.
20 degrees feels like 20,000, you know?
That's kind of how I feel. Like, I was boiling. And I have a t-shirt on, just walking, cotton pants, nothing crazy, and a t-shirt. Walking over to work, I was sweating. It's like 20 degrees out. Like, what's going on?
I was surprised to not see you in Birkenstocks today, to be honest with you.
I considered it, but I thought, hey, it's only like 19 degrees. It's not that hot. And honestly, like, I'm not big on wearing the Birkenstocks if I'm coming into work and stuff like that.
Fair enough.
You know, going through like busy areas.
It's more like casual.
Yeah. Chill. Easy.
I hear that.
Yeah.
I'm currently looking at air conditioners, so that's
that's where you're at.
Yep, that's where I'm at.
I mean, are there some available now, or are we at the same spot we were at last year where people can't find air conditioners?
So I'm going to say this, and I'm saying it because I'm very selfish. There are none available across the city.
Oh, okay.
None. Can't get them. Can't get them anywhere.
Dan is lying.
Do not go to your local Best Buy or Home Depot.
Do not believe Dan.
Do not do it.
So they still have some in stock, though, right? You were checking today. They do.
Potentially.
Yes. Okay. You better get on it.
Yeah.
We have a shorter show today, so that's a good thing. We'll be out of here. You can have a new AC unit for your apartment by the start of the first period.
It's possible.
Because it takes like 15 minutes.
Before it starts. The games haven't really started till 15 after.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you boogie when we get out of here, you could have a new AC unit for puck drop.
Might be a good topic for overrated, underrated today. Air conditioners.
Who is saying overrated? But we shall see.
Air conditioners in Vancouver are like winter tires, you know? You need it for that one or two weekends a year, the one or two snowstorms that actually come around.
Yeah.
That's when you'll really need it. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. It is an overrated, underrated Wednesday. We'll get to that in hour two of the program. If you have some last-minute submissions of things you'd like us to discuss, get them in now at 650-650, the Dunbar Lumber text line. So a lot has been going on. We talked to Ian McIntyre yesterday on the show. You can find it back on the podcast. His take on Andre Kuzmenko and what the next shoes are to drop for the Vancouver Canucks this offseason. And we're hearing it a little bit more around Vancouver. Rick Dhaliwal even saying it today after IMAX said it yesterday on our show. Maybe the draft isn't the hard deadline we sometimes make it seem to be. If the Canucks are going to make a big move, maybe it doesn't have to be by the July 7th, 8th weekend when the NHL comes together for the entry draft in Montreal.
Let's play one of my favorite games.
Okay.
The multiple things can be true game.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Heard this one before.
When is the best time if you're trading JT Miller? If you're truly exploring, really looking to make a move, when is the best time for you to make a move for JT Miller?
There's probably two. The trade deadline and the draft.
All right. But probably right now, the draft would be the best time.
Trade deadline is already in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the best time for you to make a trade. Does that mean that's the only time for you to make a trade?
No.
No. And also, the Canucks understand that this is a very important player for them. If they can't sign him, if they're trading him, they have to hit a home run with him. Okay, they're not trading Pettersson, they're not trading Demko, they're not trading Hughes. They're probably not trading Bo for as much as we talk about the possibility. We don't, because we don't know his contract situation, but it's mostly theoretical based on kind of what we're hearing and what's going on. But it's a possibility. We'll see what happens.
When everybody keeps saying, you know, it feels like Bo is going to be able to stick around and the number is going to be reasonable, then, you know.
And we'll see what happens ultimately on that end. But you're two, the only two players that could conceivably bring you real value that are conceivable trade assets or trade options are Horvat and Miller.
Yeah.
But if Miller is going to be the guy that gets traded, you got to make sure you hit on that trade. And if you're not getting an offer that gets you that one piece you really want, at the very least, you're not going to trade him. So, and that's always been true. I mean, the MO of this front office has been, we don't back ourselves into a corner. We don't have hard deadlines as far as when we have to move a player. We do it on our terms. And that's very clear. So as much as yes, it's very possible if a trade happens, it's after the draft. It could be during free agency, right after that, or whatever the case is. That it could be it. But the best time for you to really explore the trade market for him is a draft. And that's why over the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a lot of discussions and there's going to be a lot of talk and there's going to be a lot of offers being made and a lot of frameworks. And that sets the stage for whenever the team is going to pull the trigger, if they're going to pull the trigger.
The next few weeks could very well feel like the lead up to the trade deadline, where we were wondering what, if anything, may happen. It's logical that you make these steps and start this process now ahead of the draft. I do think this team will hold firm on what they think is true value for the player should they end up going down the road of moving a player of that caliber. Here's iMac from yesterday, just to give some context to the conversation on how he sees the Canucks playing it out with JT Miller.
I also think that they still have some time on their side. And, and you know, I'd say the only misleading thing about all the trade conjecture on JT Miller has been that there's, you know, an imminent deadline or there's pressure and they got to, you know, something's going to happen soon. Obviously, we're almost in July, so we're sooner to something happening now than we were, you know, back in March and February. But the Canucks, I don't think they feel like they have to make their best deal by the draft.
So there is Ian McIntyre on it. I don't think they have to make their best deal by the draft. It's just hard to see where the best deal may come from beyond the draft. And the one thing about that is, so free agency comes after the draft, Sat.
Yeah.
Right? It's July 12th this year, July 13th. So let's say a team misses out on getting Johnny Gaudreau or Evgeny Malkin, who's potentially going to be around on a short-term deal for a contender. There is quite a few players. Philip Forsberg is a big-time unrestricted free agent that could be out there. Let's say there's a contending team that misses out on signing one of those big stars, and they're still looking to add an impact player this summer. That's when maybe you have a team and a partner that really wants to go after JT Miller. Should you wait until after the draft?
And that's a very likely situation that can. I mean, it's a very possible situation. It's very likely that happens, where a team wants to go after a player, but they have other options. And once those options dry up, then they get more serious about something else they're exploring. And that's why it could drag on beyond that. Of course it could. It could drag on beyond the draft. The question does become, too, what type of draft pick are the Canucks looking for this year? You know, is it a priority to try to find a pick from this year? Or are you okay with finding a pick
for
next year? Would you, I mean, it all comes down to what the value is. You're open to either one. But that plays into the equation as well, especially for a team that is trying to reload and rebuild pretty quickly here. If you can get a pick or a prospect in from this year's draft, that's just one year sooner that guy can play for you.
Yeah. And next year's draft, yeah, it could be a lottery ticket, especially if you're betting on maybe the acquiring team ends up outside of the playoffs looking in. And that's where trading with a Metro Division team is kind of interesting because the Metro Division is loaded. You have teams like Philly and New Jersey trying to move their way up, you know, and you have Pittsburgh and Washington that are still good, but could they fall out given how competitive that division may be? That's where, you know, trading for next year's pick could be super interesting. There's a lot of options here. And the way I see it, the way I read the Canucks' new front office is they aren't in any sense going to panic about what that correct move may be. They are hard set on what they feel they need to get for JT Miller. And ultimately, and I said this in the lead up to the trade deadline, if they get a prospect, if they get that premium asset that they really like, that will tip the scales into them deciding on making that deal, then they'll do it. But if they don't see that value there, they don't feel the need to make that move right now. And at the end of the day, it is still possible that JT Miller starts next season as a Vancouver Canuck without a new contract. Maybe an unlikely scenario, but it is still one of the possible outcomes here. It just makes things, we know here in Vancouver, Sat, how much of a distraction that would be throughout the course of the year, what that could be, how ugly that could be if they're in a playoff race come trade deadline time next year. It's just not a scenario that I think anybody really wants to see play out. So it's just, it's one of the more unlikely scenarios of happening.
It is. Now, taking a quick look here at what happened last year as far as when the trades happened and when free agency happened and like when a lot of the big deals went down. So last year, free agency began, what was it, July 28th? Most of the deals happened before free agency. Trades, you know, and there were a few that happened after free agency began.
But it's rare.
It's not as many. So the vast majority of trades kind of happen in that window before free agency begins. Because by the time free agency begins, teams usually have a good sense of whether they're going to land a player or not. Especially with how, you know, discussions go with agents and teams behind the scenes and everything. You have a general idea of whether you're in the mix for a player or not. And it usually doesn't take much longer after free agency for that to happen. So maybe the draft itself is not it, but that 2 week period or that week between the draft and free agency beginning is the real sweet spot for trades.
It's a real interesting spot that the Canucks find themselves in, though, because there are quite a few forwards that are on the trade bait list, if you will. You know, Frank Saravalli puts out his trade bait list, has been updating it every week. They just added Blake Wheeler to that list. Right? That's a pretty big time piece. That could be out there and available. We know Kevin Fiala is out and available for trade. Bill Guerin made that pretty clear. Alex DeBrincat is a really interesting name as Chicago maybe goes into a rebuild. Those are all names ahead of JT Miller on Frank Saravalli's trade bait list, trade targets list. All pretty big assets that contenders may be going after. And not just contenders, but also those teams like a Detroit, a New Jersey that may be trying to make a big splash to move forward. So there's players out there and available, and JT Miller isn't the only one. I wonder what that means for trade values and such. If there is a supply out there, maybe the demand isn't quite as high. But one of the things that really helps the Canucks in that favor is JT Miller's leadership. You know, he really earned a lot of street cred this year with the, you know, heart on his sleeve, pulling the Canucks by the, you know, on his back and carrying them around into a playoff race again. That's why I think, you know, even today you hear from Dreger, Carolina may be in on JT Miller and Pittsburgh and Washington and all these teams. I mean, that's just something JT Miller has that, quite frankly, Kevin Fiala and Alex DeBrincat don't.
Now, I did some asking around about JT Miller and like, okay, so how much would you be willing to spend on this player or not? And I know I saw Elliot, I think it was, kind of mentioned that the issue with him, it's term, whether it's Vancouver and elsewhere, teams like him, but do they want to go beyond 6 years? You know, if you do 5 and 6, that could work, but beyond that, do you want to do it? I asked around a little bit. I didn't get anybody telling me that they would do 7 years.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, yeah, maybe 6. That's kind of the spot you're looking at. You know,
yeah.
Even a team that's like, if you sign him at 30 to 6 years, you might feel good about it. What's the number that Rutherford's thrown out too?
Six.
So is there a point, because what happens during this time, agents know what's going on and where teams are willing to spend. Do they get a sense that a six-year offer is the max term they're going to get?
Right.
And then it comes down to what we talked so much about, total money. And I keep saying, you got to be in the $50 million range somewhere for you to make him think. Because, yes, he may want the Zibanejad contract, but that's 60-some million.
Mm-hmm.
And is a team going to be giving him that?
The only way to know if he'll get more than six is to actually hit free agency next summer.
Yeah.
And see which team wants him bad enough that they'll just throw on the extra year of term.
But
we see so often every free agency summer.
But given that that's 1 year away,
yeah,
it's just such a big, risk to play. You know, so I think for JT's camp, I believe, and I can't say this with authority to know, and I'm not reporting this, but just from my sense is they want to get an idea of an extension this year, this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Vancouver or elsewhere, they kind of want to get that nailed down. Why wouldn't you? He's coming off a massive season. You don't know what can happen next year.
Yep. And especially if you move to another team, what happens with your opportunity? Are you the quote-unquote quarterback of the power play the way you have been here in Vancouver?
Because one thing I was told was always keep in mind that agents get a sense for what their players are going to get.
Yeah.
At what point does JT and them know?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's a week from now, but if they kind of feel like, okay, our best offer is probably going to be, somewhere in that $50 million range, $55 million maybe, some team might be giving us, nine times six or something,
Yeah.
But if Vancouver comes close to that, maybe he looks at it and says,
that
might be worth staying here, but it won't be a big discount.
Yeah. It's, it's a fascinating situation with Miller in that sense, because it's a real risk. Like, if he gets traded, what are the odds he's playing 22-plus minutes a night somewhere else?
Depends on where he goes.
Right? If he goes to Columbus, maybe.
Yeah.
But if you end up on a legit contender, or maybe they're just looking at it as, hey, we're all in for next year to try and go forward, let's go out and get JT Miller. I think that's unlikely scenario, but still possible. Yeah.
It is. I mean, I think those things are possible. For instance, I see Alice there bring up the point about Jesper Bratt in New Jersey.
Yeah.
He probably played the same role in Jersey.
Yeah.
Because Hischier plays a similar role in every situation, but Jack Hughes doesn't.
Yeah.
Whether you play Miller in the wing or down the middle, he can easily play on the PK on your power play unit on the first line. Every situation, he could go in there. And Alistair's question is, can you see a universe where Bratt for Miller happens? Maybe not one for one, but something along those lines. I mean, even one for one, it's a winger. It's not what you're looking for. It's enticing. Now, you got to pay Jesper Bratt as well, but are you willing to pay Jesper Bratt, who's what, 24 years old?
He's in line with your core age that Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin have talked about.
And this goes back to something we discussed yesterday a bit and something we talked about even a while ago. You always have to keep in mind, hockey deals can happen still, and players, young players are still being targeted by this organization. They would love to get a right-hand defenseman who's young and can play for you, but that's what they want. They really want somebody that they feel like is a difference maker. Does somebody come up and give you that type of an offer at some point?
I believe, a Jesper Bratt would be a premium asset. Are you getting a premium asset anywhere else? That's it's hard to know when we haven't seen some of the trade offers, but the one we feel concrete about is the one we heard about from the New York Rangers. And the key piece there was Nils Lundqvist.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that wasn't enough for the Canucks to pull that trigger ahead of this year's trade deadline. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. So game four of the Stanley Cup Final is coming up tonight. Tampa down 2-1. This could be a bit of a series decider, especially if Colorado wins, and it is looking like Nazem Kadri is going to play. One of the stars of the postseason has been Valeri Nichushkin. Mm-hmm. Breakout stars. He had a big year for Colorado in general, but given where he was with Dallas a few years ago and ending up in free agency, a bust of a 10th overall pick, signs $850K in Colorado a few seasons ago, and here he is on the brink of hitting free agency and probably making five or six sheets this offseason. he's become one of the best, undeniable best two-way wingers in the game. And that's really shone through this postseason. Now, yeah, you can go out and sign Valeri Nichushkin this offseason. It's going to cost you, probably. But how do you find the next Valeri Nichushkin? That's really the question, not just the Canucks, but every team should be asking. Like, okay, yeah, we love that player. We need that player. Who's the next guy? We don't want to have to pay $6 million for that guy. We want the one that's cheaper.
Yeah, it's like it's the discussions we've had about other types of role players. Instead of going and signing Nick Paul, go find the next Nick Paul. That's what you have to do. I mean, that's kind of where you're at. Instead of paying premium, go and find the next guy or try to find the next guy in different ways. And there are three different avenues you can really explore to find the next Nichushkin. The draft, obviously.
Yep.
That's a harder thing. There's the internal side of things. Maybe just look at Vasily Podkolzin. Mm-hmm. That's your guy. Maybe that's who's going to be Nichushkin anyways down the road. But if you look at, okay, what type of players could you be targeting in trade potentially, or guys that can become available in free agency, I keep coming back to a few names. And especially a name that you've brought up a lot as well.
Oh, I think I know where you're going.
Miles Wood. Yep. RFA, if you look at his statistical profile, a lot of similarities to Nichushkin, especially defensively. Offensively, a bit different, but defensively, look at it, there's some similarities. He may not get qualified. He's coming off an injury, could be a cheap bet type of player. That's a similarity there to Nichushkin. Kasperi Kapanen as well. You may wonder, why is Kapanen on that list? His qualifying offer and arbitration rights may not be cheap for Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
He may not get qualified.
May end up as an unrestricted free agent.
Or gets traded for cheap, or whatever it is, or whatever. He's a guy that could be available. You look at his defensive profile, there's some similarities to Nichushkin, especially if you look at the straight-up defensive metrics in his own zone and preventing goals from happening. They're very similar in that regard. And Pierre Engvall for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah.
Has Arbrights, young player, somebody could offer sheet him. Not a big-time player, but again, some similarities. He's going to get qualified, but it depends on what Toronto wants to do. Is he a guy who's available? What would you give up to acquire him? Might be on the more expensive end of things.
He's a guy that's super long, you know, good for the PK, skates well. You know, not just the numbers. Every time I watch Pierre Engvall, like, there's some things you don't love about his game, but you can see a player in there that could really fill out a role in your bottom six. The one player I can't get away from, yes, Miles Wood, but it's Jesse Puljujärvi. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk to Daniel Nugent-Bowman here in a minute. I think his offseason and the situation with him this offseason is fascinating because we don't know exactly what Edmonton wants. Sat dropped his coffee, so he's in a little bit of a panic mode.
And I spilled a little bit of it on my laptop, and then I dropped it again on the table. And Josh is on the other side of the glass. He's like, throws his hands up in there. He's like, what's wrong with you?
Embarrassing to watch.
Like, this is, you're so disappointed.
It was a tough watch. You did it once, and then you did it a second time. Might have to throw the keyboard into a bowl of rice. Jesse Puljujärvi is one of the most fascinating players in the league this offseason for me. I think everybody should want Jesse Puljujärvi. I think Edmonton should keep Jesse Puljujärvi. It's very simple to just look at what he's done from a statistical profile standpoint and see what works with this player. And you know what? When he played with Connor McDavid, guess what? The results were significantly better for the Oilers on the ice. Like, he allowed Connor McDavid to be at his absolute best when he was out there. He's got some puck skills, doesn't have a ton of finishing ability, which frustrates you. But he does a lot of those little things well that help great players be great players on the ice.
And see, it's so interesting you mentioned that because when you look at the numbers, all those things you said, those things are supported by the numbers. When I watch Jesse Puljujärvi, however, I don't get the same sense when I'm watching him. So that's why when I was going through this list and thinking of players and then looking at the statistical profile to see the similarities, I didn't expect to see Puljujärvi there, but he was there. And that kind of challenged how I view the player, and that's why I'm interested in our conversation coming up here a moment about, okay, what is he really? Is he as good defensively, or is that more a product of who he's playing with and circumstances and maybe just not being as aggressive? Is he actually good defensively, or was that just a product of the circumstances? Because if he actually is good defensively and he is able to be had relatively cheap, then he becomes a big value proposition. But you have to wonder, why did two head coaches find the same flaws with him?
The thing I feel that gets put on Puljujarvi is he was a fourth overall pick, expected to be able to put up points, and his finishing ability just hasn't been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, hey, this guy's played this many minutes with Connor McDavid. How come his points aren't adding up? You know, like, what? Where's the disconnect there?
Yeah.
Like, this guy's not scoring enough to play with Connor McDavid, but Connor McDavid had over 120 points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, had his best moments on the ice and his most productive moments on the ice when he was playing with Puljujarvi. So forget about what Puljujarvi's doing. He's allowing your best player to be at his absolute best, and I think that makes it very interesting, especially as an ad for the Canucks, but one that I wonder if the Oilers prioritize signing an Evander Kane, and because of that, mm-hmm. Puljujarvi becomes a cap casualty. The other name I'll throw out there, and I know I'm not the only one, but Nicholas Waugh is somebody that I keep looking at. He's a guy who can play center and can play the wing, also a right shot center. So I think he'll be highly coveted should Vegas not sign him. He is a restricted free agent this summer.
I think they find a way to keep him.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I think he's too valuable for them.
I've asked around about him too, and the sense I get is like, hey, you know, everybody loves him, right? And he's like, yeah, of course. They love him too. I was like, yes. Yeah.
Everybody loves Nick Waugh. Guess what? Vegas does too. Yes. Okay. Right. So maybe I'm going to have to lay off that pipe dream
but it depends.
For this summer.
I mean, they're in a spot. They have to make a big decision. They have to clear cap space. And we've seen them make other moves. Just because they don't want to trade him doesn't mean they may not end up trading him, obviously, right?
You wonder if the number just gets too much for them, right? If it ends up $3.5-4 million to keep Nick Waugh, that might be trouble for Vegas. All right, Daniel Nugent-Bowman's going to join us next. We'll get his take on Puljujarvi and what might happen with him this offseason. The Oilers keeping Jay Woodcroft around, but what does their offseason look like? Questions in goal, questions on D. How do they push forward after a Western Conference final appearance where they got swept? That's coming up next on Canucks Central. Canuck Central, a presentation of your local Grip Auto and Tire location. Friendly service and expert advice are waiting for you at gripauto.ca today. What I've learned on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox, 650-650. Vancouver Canucks fans, not fans of Jesse Puljujärvi.
A lot of reaction on the text inbox.
Mike, Puljujärvi is brutal. Dan, he fails the eye test. Tanbeer, not a fan of Puljujarvi. I'm with you, Sat. I don't see the analytics support. Mike also saying he is a gigantic thumb.
Gigantic thumb. Yeah. Somebody else texted in, Jeff and East Hill. He has hands of stones. Couldn't hit the side of a barn. He played like the best player in the league. He was horrible. Even Connor didn't want to play with him. That's how bad he was.
That's
a lot of hate for Jesse Puljujarvi.
not a lot of love for Jesse Puljujarvi. He's an interesting part of the Oilers offseason, and one trade target, as we've talked about, that could be a Valeri Nichushkin prototype. Let's bring in our next guest. He is Daniel Nugent Bowman, covering the Oilers for The Athletic. Thanks for this, Daniel. We've been talking about who could be, you know, the next Valeri Nichushkin, as he's had the massive breakout and is probably getting a pretty big contract this summer, either from Colorado or from somebody else. Do you think Jesse Puljujarvi can be that type of a strong two-way forward?
Well, you're hitting me with the tough one right off the top. He's a very polarizing figure here in Edmonton. There's there's a joke on Twitter during the playoffs that he was either considered the front runner for the Conn Smythe Trophy or an ECHLer, and there was no middle ground between the fan base, members of the fan base. But I don't know if I go quite that far, but I do see a lot of similarities there between Puljujarvi and Nichushkin, just in the way that their careers have been, you know, both going over back to Europe in the middle of a kind of a lousy kind of start to their careers or an up and down, maybe starts of their careers where there have been some starts and stops from the first organizations that they're with. Obviously, Puljujärvi still with that first organization here in Edmonton. He had a very good year last year and a very good, an excellent start to the season with 24 points in 28 games. The reason I would not give up on this player is, you know, we're talking about 60-odd games where things didn't go very well. He had a COVID stint in there, another illness, an injury too. And through all that, he's been a pretty reliable player in the way that he's played, you know, a safe player. At the very worst, I think you're getting a very competent, you know, third-line player who can drive some play. And I mean, just the way his start of the year went, again, where he had that offense next to Connor McDavid, I think he lost his confidence in the back half of the year. And if I were him, I'd be working with the skills coach around that home plate area just to finish off chances, to start picking corners from that area and maybe work on that, you know, but running out that offensive game. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, just a solid two-way player is not what you want from somebody who was drafted fourth overall. But in this day and age, I think he's probably going to come in at around $3 million or so, maybe a touch more on the next contract. I mean, that's a pretty good, you know, deal for somebody who plays that way. The concern, I guess, for the Oilers is you want more offense from somebody who's been in the top six all year. He obviously fell kind of lower down in the lineup as the playoffs went on. And the other concern is obviously he is 2 years away from unrestricted free agency. But the Oilers are pretty cash-strapped and tight against the salary cap. And, you know, I think there's a player there potentially waiting to bust out in terms of the offensive game. And you might be able to get kind of a bargain, you know, if he's coming in at $3 or $3.5 million or something like that, maybe even a little bit less. And he gets, you know, he really breaks out here next season, that could be a real win for this organization. So I don't think I would give up on him yet. Mm-hmm. I see some similarities to Nikushkin, but I do see some of the concern, you know, with the organization and some of the members of the fan base. You know, this player is now 24 years old. He's not young anymore, but he's still young enough where I don't think he's quite plateaued yet.
Yeah, I think the question really becomes sometimes, is he going to be able to realize his potential in Edmonton for a number of reasons? One, is he always going to be burdened with the expectation of being as high a pick as he was? And mm-hmm. does he need to go somewhere else where that expectation is not there and that kind of unburdens him, allows him to be a bit freer? I mean, that could theoretically be something, because when I watch him play, I'm kind of with you, Daniel, because I see some good qualities in him, but I don't see this elite defensive player. I see a guy who's safe, but I'm not sure he's good defensively. And I think there's a difference between being somebody who attacks defensively and is really good at closing and doing those things and being safe. But the numbers really point to him being similar to a lot of good defensive forwards in the game. And that's where it's interesting sometimes, because the eye test and the analytics don't really match up sometimes on Jesse Puljujärvi. And I think that also leads to why he's so polarizing.
Yeah, and I get that for sure. You know, I would say, in terms of Puljujärvi, to your first point, I think that's entirely fair. You look at Nikushkin, you look at, it's a very different scenario, but even somebody like Nazem Kadri, really, sometimes the player doesn't need a change of scenery, and it really sparks something in that player. You know, there's less, as you say, well, you know, with Puljujärvi, I don't think he's ever going to quite be that number four, you know, talent in terms of a pure offense that you'd hope to get from somebody of that position. And maybe if you go somewhere where the spotlight isn't quite as bright, you know, he can go and just be a little freer. But, you know, that's certainly a possibility. The one thing I would add, I guess, about Puljujärvi is, you know, I think he does a lot of things, you know, well around the ice. I get what you're saying about the kind of elite defensive, you know, parts of his game and the eye test maybe not matching the analytics, but you could put him next to McDavid and have him be safe, which is probably not exactly the type of player you want there. But I think he's really best suited, at least at this point. And, you know, again, maybe the offense really kind of shines through in next season. But if the Oilers are to keep him, you know, a guy like Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, to me, really needs a supportive and helpful winger next to him. I don't think Nugent Hopkins is the type of centerman, if they are going to keep him at center, that is really a play driver and can really carry a line on his own. And a guy like Puljujärvi, when they have had moments together, playing together, I think there's some potential, and there has been some effectiveness there between those two. And so you could put those two guys on a third line, especially against, you know, teams that aren't as good. I think that line can really match up well and get some offense. And against teams where, they're a bit deeper, that line can maybe help, keep the puck out of their end, which has been a huge problem for the Oilers, their bottom six over the last number of years. It's certainly gotten better under Jay Woodcroft. But, I think there's still, again, for the type of salary that he's probably going to command this offseason and probably for the next 2 years, before potential unrestricted free agency, I think the Oilers could do a lot worse than having Puljujärvi in the lineup for that type of salary.
So Jay Woodcroft extended. It was a quite good finish to the season, obviously for him, and how he handled taking over for Dave Tippett. Your take on the Oilers continuing with Jay Woodcroft and if this was the right move?
Yeah, I think it was a no-brainer. I mean, when the Oilers get to the third round of the playoffs for the first time in 16 years, you probably want to retain the coach that got you there. The Oilers had the third highest points percentage at 724 from the time that Woodcroft was hired until the end of the regular season. Only Calgary and Florida were ahead of them. And he really did a lot, I think, to kind of transform this team. When he was hired, the Oilers were really in the dumps. They were in the dumps for more than 2 months, and they'd gone from first place in the league by points percentage on December 2nd to being out of the playoffs and really taking a nosedive in December and well into January before things kind of turned around a little bit, but it was kind of a brief blip before he was hired. And the structure of their game really changed, where they had, forwards coming back through the neutral zone a lot harder, defensemen standing up at the blue line better. Their neutral zone play was much, much improved. And part of that, I mean, they just had Evander Kane brought in, and they finally got some healthy and good goaltending out of Mike Smith. But the way they started playing, with a few exceptions, obviously you saw some high numbers being put on them against Calgary late in the regular season, and a couple of game ones there in the playoffs. But despite those exceptions, I think they played incredibly well for the most part under Jay Woodcroft, and certainly much better than they had for those 2 months before he was hired. And, the players talk a lot about how detailed he is, getting to start as a video coach. I think there's a lot of detail in his approach and the way he communicates with players, and somebody who's very positive and really connects with not only the stars of the team, but the guys that aren't playing a lot and maybe even aren't playing at all. He finds a way to keep them engaged, and I think this team is a lot better for having Jake Woodcroft around, or has been anyway, and they're obviously hoping that can continue into next season.
Is it sometimes also as simple as getting your star players on board? And it certainly seems like McDavid and Dreisaitl specifically are really like Woodcroft.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And they have that familiarity with Woodcroft, who is an assistant coach for the team for 3 years from the time McDavid stepped into the league, which was, really Dreisaitl's first year as well. He'd obviously played the first half of the previous season before heading back into junior. So he has that familiarity with McDavid, Dreisaitl, certainly Darnell Nurse, who's their number one defenseman. We mentioned Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. They all know him pretty well. Then he knows a lot of these guys very well, who've come up through the minor leagues in Bakersfield, having coached there for 3.5 years before joining the Oilers. So he's connected with a lot of these guys. They know him well, and there's a good fit between them and the organization. Of course, sometimes it doesn't always work that way, work out perfectly. You don't want necessarily a guy coming into, I guess what I'm trying to say is, when an assistant coach sometimes becomes a head coach, it doesn't always work. But he had that 3.5 years of running his own bench and learning how to make decisions and be the last guy kind of standing in front of those decisions. And he's certainly kind of been on the right track for the last few years, and this team has really connected with him.
So what's the first thing on Ken Holland's priority list this summer?
Oh, he's got a lot of things he's got to figure out to me. I think that obviously getting the coach back was, to me, a big one, but rather a formality. Once he figures out what's happening with Mike Smith, and it sure sounded from his, from Mike Smith's season-ending media availability a couple of years ago, or a couple of weeks ago, rather, that I would say retirement or not playing next year is a very distinct possibility, and therefore they're probably going to need a number one goaltender. And that's a big, big, obviously, position to fill, but also a huge task for Ken Holland because he doesn't have a lot of cap space. He's got about $8 million, give or take, with 15 players under contract. So there's not a lot. The goaltending market is pretty thin. And Mike Smith, for all his, I know he's kind of a lightning rod in terms of how, eccentric or whatnot he is in the net. And he has had some gaffes, but down the stretch, I would, and for a good part of the playoffs, played pretty well, and only is that a $2.2 million cap hit. So whether he retires and that money comes completely off the books, or he goes on long-term injury and they're into LTIR, the Oilers are going to spend a lot more than the $2.2 million, are probably going to have to spend a lot more than that to replace Mike Smith. So when you're already cap, have your cap concerns and need to replace somebody who wasn't making a lot of money against the cap, that's a real challenging part for the general manager. And you know what? He doesn't have too many guys on big contracts either that are tradable. All of their big guys are, you're certainly not trading Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl. And then you have guys like, Zach Hyman and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, mm-hmm. Darnell Nurse, that are all having, no move or no trade protections as well. So it's really, to me, the three guys that make a little bit of money and potentially could be moved to open up a bit of cap space. You're looking at Tyson Barrie, Zach Cassian, mm-hmm. and potentially even Warren Fogle as well. But, he makes a little bit less at 2.75. So he's going to almost certainly have to open up a bit of cap space to improve this team. I mentioned Evander Kane earlier, and there's far from a guarantee that he's going to be back, and you got to replace potentially those 22 goals from the regular season and the 13 that he scored in the playoffs too. So, there's a lot on Ken Holland's offseason list here, and it'll be a very interesting few weeks to come for the Oilers management.
Well, you mentioned, the challenges and what you have to do to open up that cap space, and that's what they're going to have to do if they want to have a real chance at signing Evander Kane. What do you think the likelihood is of them finding a way to keep him, or is there a sense of perhaps Evander is going to look elsewhere?
Yeah, I would say there is a chance, just because things went so well for him here. Mm-hmm. He did speak very highly of the organization, but I see it probably pretty unlikely. Again, they don't have a lot of cap space. They have a lot of things to address. Ken Holland has a lot of needs and issues to address with a very limited budget. Not only that, but this time, certainly Evander Kane has should have more of his pick of the litter in terms of teams that would be interested in him. Still don't think he'd probably want to go super long with Kane, given his past, wearing out welcomes with previous teams. But when he signed with the Oilers in January, we're in the middle of the season and teams have their rosters and caps pretty close to set, and there were not a lot of options. And of course, he was in the doghouse in terms of a lot of teams around the league, given he had just been suspended for almost a quarter, or I guess a quarter of the season. He's been able to put together a few good months in terms of, good behavior and good months in terms of hockey. Again, 22 regular season goals in 43 games, I believe it was, and the 13 and 15 playoff games. He's going to have a lot more options, he gets to kind of pick and choose what he wants to do. He did the perfect thing and part of the smart thing in terms of coming to Edmonton. Everyone knew that he would get a chance to play next to one of Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl, and he did that exclusively. He never played with anyone but one of those two players as a centerman, and obviously worked out tremendously for him. It was a smart business decision, and I think probably that's where it will remain, a business decision that now allows him to apply his trade elsewhere.
Daniel, we really appreciate the insight. Should be an interesting offseason. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
There is Daniel Nugent-Bowman covering the Oilers at The Athletic. Question to the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Why do people think Mike Smith's cap hit comes off the books if he retires? It's an age 35-plus contract. Did they change that? There was a rule amendment in 2020, I believe, to change that. So it's not the same as it was originally. A player can retire and the cap hit would come off the books should it meet certain criteria. And I believe Mike Smith hits those. You can find the full details at Cap Friendly should you want to go find it out.
Cap schmap. I mean, always find ways to finagle the retirement thing. I mean,
if it's better for them to keep him on the roster and have him on LTIR, they will do that.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Sure, Mike Smith won't be too too upset at taking the paycheck. It's the Oilers are a really interesting team this offseason. You know, they like a lot of teams have they have cap issues, you know? And so whether it's Puljujarvi or even a name that Daniel mentioned there that I'd almost forgotten about because he just had such a nondescript season with the Edmonton Oilers, Warren Fogle. And I liked him a lot in Carolina. It just didn't really work for him in Edmonton.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, one thing I was going to mention while we have Daniel on, if you want the best bounce back option on that team, I think it probably is Warren Fogle.
Yeah.
If you can, I'd move Cassian in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can move him and get off that money, do it. I don't even care what you get. Just, and it, not that he's that bad. He can help you, but it's so, you know where it's going to go. And I'd rather have the money, especially because he could just fall off a cliff so quickly. And he's getting close to that too. Sometimes he's good and sometimes he's really behind the play. So that's the guy that I don't mind holding on to. And Jesse Puljujärvi, like, it's interesting because what Daniel mentioned, and I think it's fair, he's probably better defensively than I've given him credit for. And sometimes this is where bias does comes in.
Yeah.
You see a guy, you don't like certain parts of his game, and it's hard for you to overcome that. And then you got to look at other things and be like, okay, what's happening here? But part of the reason, too, is, and that confidence isn't there, he's burdened by being a failed draft pick.
Yeah.
It's kind of where the Canucks were with a couple of draft picks of years past. You know, we don't need to mention the names. People all know the guy taken, what was it, seventh overall, sixth overall, and the guy taken sixth overall and fifth overall.
Yeah.
And you looked at, no matter what they did or didn't do, it was always going to fall short.
Yeah.
Even if they hit their potential, this guy will be a middle six guy, maybe a second line guy. And it's like, is that what you drafted him for? And, you know, if things went well for the defenseman, it was like, oh, maybe this guy's a third pair guy. And it's like, well, is that good for a fifth overall pick and that sort of thing? And I do think that psychologically does affect players, especially within an organization. And especially for a guy like him who keeps hitting the same kind of ceiling with different coaches. I think he's got to have to go from there. And fans may regret it, and it may look bad in a couple of years, but I don't know if he's going to be the player he can be in that organization.
I've always thought that that's more pronounced in a Canadian market where the fans are just always on you. If you're a top 10 pick, you have such high expectations to be a huge hit. And when you're not, that can be a really, really big burden. Puljujärvi's turned out to be a decent player, but is he a fourth overall pick? Is he the impact player you would have hoped to get there at fourth overall? Probably not. All right.
I like this text, though. Got it from Reg. My biggest concern with Puljujärvi is the helmet. It's two sizes too small.
He does have a lot of quirks about him, and his tongue is always sticking out as well, as you'll find on Oilers Twitter. I like the player. I think he would be a great addition for the Canucks. I also think a lot of teams are probably looking at his statistical profile and saying, yep, we could use that guy on our team. Will be interesting to see if he does end up getting moved this summer. Bet on hockey like never before with Play Now Sports, your local BC sportsbook. It is game 4 of the Stanley Cup Final tonight. the Tampa Bay Lightning looking to make it two in a row on home ice. The task made a little bit more difficult, Sat, as Nazem Kadri is in for game four.
Ooh.
His first of these Stanley Cup finals.
Yeah.
Braden Point is obviously out, but given how he was playing, maybe it's actually not a bad thing, given he's just not where you need him to be. It is an absolute pick'em tonight over at playnow.com. Both teams on the money line, $1.90. Mm-hmm. So it is who you like versus who you don't. A pick'em. You're not getting much either way.
You're not. And I think what this really does show is how much money is on Tampa mm-hmm. to even this series. And I think there's also a lot of wishful thinking on Tampa evening the series because there were probably some futures bets made. And not some bad ones. So I wonder if the line, if it being a pick'em, might be more of a reflection of where the money's at as opposed to who the odds-on favorite is to win this hockey game. But I like Tampa tonight to win this and then at least get it to that game five. And if they do, it has to kind of happen with goaltending being shaky because that's what can get in your head. Because if Kadri comes back, it doesn't really help you out that much. You realize, okay, well, he is what he is at this point.
Yeah.
He's not going to be able to do more than what he's doing. And if your goaltending is a problem, then that starts getting in your head. You were up 2-0. Your goalie is a bit of an issue. Tampa has to win this one, obviously. But if goaltending is shaky, then I really like Tampa for the series. That's why the series odds are still in the favor of Tampa if you're looking for some value.
Yeah, 340 right now still on the over at playnow.com to bet Tampa for the series. You can get in before game four right now. Speaking of goaltending, we'll talk to our goalie guru. What would he do with the Avalanche goal? Kevin Woodley is next on Canuck Central. Hour number two of Canuck Central. It is presented by Andrew Sherritt Limited, your plumbing and heating wholesaler, a proud family-owned BC company helping local business since 1892. Kevin Woodley is going to join us in a couple of moments. Our goalie guru, his take on what Colorado should do here. Hour one of the show, we talked about what the deadlines are for the Vancouver Canucks if the draft is, in fact, a deadline for the Canucks when it comes to the draft and trading, making that one big move that they seem to need to make this summer. Could it be before the draft? Could it be afterwards? Also, how do you find the next Valerian Nichushkin? We talked about Jesse Puljujarvi and then spoke with Daniel Nugent-Bowman about Puljujarvi and what the Oilers could get up to this offseason. I love seeing some of the votes coming out today, Sat. Like, we see how it really played out. Seth Rohrbaugh out of Pittsburgh was the only reporter, the only member of the PHWA, who did not have McDavid or Matthews on his Hart ballot.
Nope.
But he did have JT Miller at fifth. So he's the only person who had JT Miller on his ballot as well.
That ballot is a trip.
I think he had Kaprizov number one. That's pretty great.
Yeah. I don't even mind picking Kaprizov for the Hart. You can make the argument for him being the most valuable player to his team, how that team performed. I mean, there's an argument to be made for him, but just leaving David.
This is the thing about most valuable, though. Like, anybody can make an argument about anything.
Yeah.
Because I think he was the most valuable player to his team.
Yeah. Like, we can make an argument that the most valuable member of our show is Kevin Woodley.
It usually is, especially on Wednesdays. He is our next guest, Ingle Magazine and NHL.com. It is Kevin Woodley. What's happening, Woodley?
Not much. Just enjoying the fact that this strange golden thing in the sky has come to join us once again. So
funny how, like,
a nice change.
Summer begins officially, and the sun starts to come out, and we're on the brink of our first heat wave. Are air conditioners overrated or underrated? What do you think?
That's not even a question.
Like, they are, if you don't have one, they're underrated. Come on. Like,
yeah.
I got to be careful here. I've got an air conditioner in my current home. our last place that we bought out in South Surrey, so the first time we bought a home as a family and had a new baby and had a west exposure. And so when the sun would go to set, it would just bake through the back windows and the whole place, like to the point where, like, little babies could not sleep. Little babies got rashes because of the heat type of thing. So we had to install an air conditioner then. And to be honest, so that's what, like 18 years now that I've lived in the lap of air conditioned luxury. Mm. I could not imagine going back. I mean, on days like today, no big deal. But as soon as it starts to get up in the mid 20s, especially if you happen to live in an east or a west exposed house, like you almost got to have it nowadays.
I may be heading out after the show to find one. So that's how I'm preparing for the first heat wave of the summer. All right.
Probably should have done it last week when we did it for an apartment that my daughter's going to be occupying in university next year. Ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
If you wait till it gets hot, you're probably too late, bud.
Well, nobody ever confused me for being smart. So that's the caveat.
We work in the media.
100%. So. Stanley Cup final. It's been such a story about goaltending so far, whether it's Vasilevsky or now it's shifted to Colorado's end after Kemper gives up, what, 5 goals on 22 shots. If you're Jared Bednar, how are you playing the goaltending situation?
I mean, it looks like they're going to go with Kemper again tonight, and I'd probably do the same. Sort of one last kick at the can for him, if you will, the way I look at it. Because the reality is, as much as he hasn't been great in these playoffs, neither has the guy that's the, you know, next man up, Pavel Francouz. And I say that, everyone's going to be like, oh, the argument I heard was, he's won 6 in a row. Like, he's won 6 straight starts. How do you not start him? Well, when I look at some of the adjusted numbers, like, neither one of these guys, they're both negative. They're both below expected. Up until the last game, Darcy was slightly less so. And basically, he dropped a spot out of the 30 goalies that have played a game in the playoffs. Mm. Francouz now ranks 22nd, and Kemper just dropped below him at 23rd. So, like, neither one of these guys has been a world beater for you. And yet, from an experience standpoint, and I guess maybe less so experience and more so ceiling, I think that Darcy, especially in the second half of the season, showed that he has a higher ceiling than Pavel Francouz. And so, you know, you give him another opportunity to sort of find that game and see if he can, you know, hit that level, and that's going to be enough. And if he doesn't, now you've got a much tougher decision in game 5. But the reality is the same thing could have happened to Pavel Francouz, and then now all of a sudden you're bouncing back and forth. So I like the idea of sticking with him one more game. I don't know that there's a huge discrepancy between the two style-wise. I think Francouz is obviously a little smaller, mm-hmm. a little more mobile, but I'm not sure that you would say that mobility was Darcy's issue in that game. So, I don't mind the decision to stick with it just because I don't know that they have a definitively better option. And so giving Darcy one more shot before you maybe pull the trigger on a change, to me, makes a lot of sense. And at the end of the day, like, this is the reality for the Colorado Avalanche. The first 2 games, they outplayed them so decisively that goaltending wasn't a factor. And if they can maintain the type of edge they had in the first 2 games, it probably won't be again. But if Colorado tilts the, or if Tampa Bay tilts the scale anywhere near even, and it, you know, I mean, that's pretty much where it ended up last game. I think Colorado had, you know, just under 4 expected goals, and Tampa Bay was 3.5. Obviously, Tampa scored 6, and Colorado only scored 2. But if it comes out in the wash and they're a 50-50 battle, that's where goaltending makes the difference. Like, Colorado needs to be that much better in its execution, particularly in its own end, and in terms of the chances they generate, in order to sort of overcome the battle. And they were in the first 2, but if there's not much margin for error between the 2 teams in terms of how they're playing and what they're creating, there's no question that the advantage goes to Tampa Bay because of Andre Vasilevsky. And yet, in the first 2 games, when Colorado was generating what they did, they're capable of sort of erasing him as a factor. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, they have the ability to play with such a wide edge, wide advantage in terms of shot quality and what they create, that he doesn't matter. But as soon as things start to even up, I mean, it's hard to argue that the advantage isn't, like, just so far on Tampa Bay's side just because of what's going on between the pipes.
So on Vasilevskiy then, should there be any concerns, or did he plug all the holes already?
Yeah, I don't know if he plugged all the holes. Like, there was exposure there. You know, you look at some of the remarkable saves that he made, extended toes, just getting a leg on it. And to me, that's some of this is defensive pressure and the fact there's somebody near the guy as he's trying to convert that chance. I think it was JT Compher on one, if not two of them. But that's also execution offensively. Like, if you've got a guy that down and out, I'm sorry. Like I know Colorado's goalie coach, Jussi Parkkila, will have a scouting report that will make this very clear because, I mean, my God, it's been in our NHL.com sort of pre-scouts for the playoffs for like 4 years now. If you don't elevate, if you give him a chance by keeping it along the ice, even though you think you're shooting at an empty net, you're giving Andrei Vasilevskiy a chance to make a momentum-changing save. And so when I look at the execution on those types of chances, man, like at minimum, every one of those has to be 12 inches off the ice. Like you can't give him a he's got so much length in the lower body. He's able to generate pushes and power and rotation and coverage down low, even when it looks like he's totally out of a play, no matter how extended he is. And, you know, I just think offensively, you can't give him that chance. Like, that gives him a chance not just to make the save, but to make momentum-changing saves when you think there's an empty net. And so as much as the focus is on Kemper not getting the job done in the last game, I think offensively, with some of the grade A's that they did create, they just didn't execute in finishing them. You know, with a goalie like Vasilevskiy, and you saw in game two when they did execute, when they hit their spots, I mean, clearly looking low blocker over the pad on a couple of clean looks off the rush. You know, some of the low high plays, he has a tendency when pucks get behind his net to go paddle down on the blocker side, which not only creates some exposure if you can pull that puck above the goal line and route it up over his shoulder because he's got that double coverage along the ice, but he tends to reach with that paddle down and with the stick. And you saw it in game two. I mean, you work a low-high pass out of that, and because he's pulled his body past his post and sort of pulled himself out of position trying to cut that pass off, he's late to recover back to middle, and there's exposure there that they took advantage of. And, you know, I think the Rangers did a good job of that as well, a couple of goals in similar fashion. So, you know, when Colorado was able to execute the type of plays they wanted, they created chances and hit spots that, you know, sort of play right into the book on Andrei Vasilevskiy, and you saw exposure there, and that exposure's still there. The difference is they weren't able to create quite as many looks, and they weren't executing when they had them. And again, part of that is Tampa doing a better job sort of being there to take away sticks, to take away time, to make sure that it's not easy to convert those chances, that you can't just sort of take your time and make sure you elevate and hit the top half of the net. So part of that is their better defensive posture. But I think we've seen in these series when Colorado executes, Andre, you know, there's exposure there. There are things you can do to score on him. And we've seen a few more maybe highs and lows in these playoffs as some teams have managed to execute on that. But as the playoffs have gone on, as each series has gone on, Tampa's done a good job of taking away that time and space required to do so. And so to me, that's the real battle. It's not just the finishing and the execution. It's can you manufacture the looks and enough of them in the first place? And then part B, are you executing on the finish? And that was the part to me that was lacking in that last game because, you know, even with one called back, there were certainly opportunities there for Colorado to have four or five goals themselves.
So we're seeing the musical chairs of head coaches start to take place around the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
Cassidy to Vegas, DeBoer to Dallas. Now Paul Maurice is heading to Florida. What does that mean for some of the goalies in place in those situations?
Well, I mean, if you're Jake Oettinger in Dallas, I'm sure Jake's not worried about it. Let's just say if you're playing fantasy hockey next year and you got to pick a goalie in the late rounds and you had Jake Oettinger all lined up to be your guy because of what he did in the playoffs and he was incredible against Calgary, I think you think twice. Because I think that Pete DeBoer, especially in Vegas, as much as sort of the DNA of the Dallas Stars for the past several years under Rick Bonus has been defensive hockey and defense-first hockey. And I think during the regular season they had trouble maintaining that consistently, but you saw in the playoffs when that focus returned that they still had it in them. They knew how to do it, and once they started executing it, as good as Ottinger was, they were also really good in front of him. DeBoer in Vegas was a guy that leaned heavily on his goaltending, at times too much. They're a team that gave up a ton of grade A chances. Given the pedigree, given the personnel he had, they seemed content to trade chances. They relied on Fleury to play at a Vezina-like clip to have the success they had 2 years ago when he won the Vezina Trophy. And they needed Robin Lehner, frankly, through the first quarter of this past season to play, you know, at a Vezina-type level, sort of to keep them in the race. And once he fell off, So did Vegas, to the point where, as we all know, they didn't make the playoffs. And so I think under DeBoer, obviously personnel can dictate how a coach game plans and what types of systems and where his focus is. And maybe because of Dallas's, like I said, DNA and history defensively, maybe there will be more focus on that for him there. But sort of history, at least recent history, tells us that the goalies are going to be leaned on a lot heavier there than they have in the past. Not sure about Paul Maurice. I think in Florida, they were one of the better defensive teams this year as is, and they were so good offensively that I think there were times, and in the playoffs especially, where you know maybe some of that stuff wasn't second nature, where they got away without scoring some of their mistakes during the season and thought maybe they could in the playoffs. Paul Maurice in Winnipeg, as good as Connor Hellebuck was, I'm not sure he got enough credit for how well they defended. And I don't know if this was by design. I got to think at least some part of it was. What they were really good at there was taking away the tight. They were good at sort of creating a defensive structure that played to the strengths of their Vezina Trophy winning goaltender in Connor Hellebuck. Like, to me, Hellebuck is at his best. I mean, to a certain degree, all goaltenders are, but Hellebuck in particular, if you're attacking him in straight lines, he's going to eat you up. If you can move the puck east-west more consistently, you know, you give yourself a better chance of exposing him. And in his best years there, and this is why some of the data at ClearSight didn't quite match not just some of the publicly kept data, but even, you know, some of the other companies' data in terms of Connor Hellebuck's level of play, because not a lot of the other ones have that east-west slot line pass factored into their expected goals and expected save percentage models. And Winnipeg was really good at limiting those types of chances, even on the power play. They would give up really what appeared to be really good looks, and guys just sort of walking in on Connor Hellebuck. I remember that a couple of years ago, and people were like, wow, like they're giving up a ton. But it was always straight lines, not a lot of laterals. And so, you know, obviously a totally different team, a totally different dynamic in terms of what he has to work with there. But I would expect for them to be better defensively on a whole. And, you know, whether it, you know, we'll see, is it Bob who's still there? A lot of rumors around him right now. Or whether it's a young Spencer Knight moving up and taking more of those minutes, that bodes well for the goaltenders. Not that they were necessarily in tough in the past, because, you know, even just sort of knowing that the team's going to outscore a mistake or two every night for you is just a huge load off for goalies. But I think the types of chances they see could get even easier just, you know, based on Paul Maurice's track record and the history he has. I would say the same of Vegas with Bruce Cassidy. Again, everything changes with different personnel, and a coach has to adjust to that. But if we see anything like what we saw to him in Boston, under sort of towards the tail end of Tuca's last couple of years, there was a lot of chances. But this year with new goalies in place, they really tightened up in front of Linus Ullmark and in front of young Jeremy Swayman this year, and gave them relatively easy environments to compared to what had been in the past. And if you compare that to, like I was saying, DeBoer in Vegas, things just got a lot easier for the goaltenders of the Golden Knights.
Now, when we see all these new head coaches, it also means new staffs, whether that's assistant coaches, sometimes goalie coaches. Can that have any sort of an impact of where with Vancouver, considering Curtis Sanford is an up and rising goalie coach and he's not the main guy in Vancouver?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. Like, I mentioned this on the morning show a couple of weeks back. With all the openings for goalie coaches around the league, and obviously at the time, I think the reason it was on the radar was Toronto had just announced that they were moving on from Steve Briere as their goaltending coach. That opened up another job. Detroit's obviously open. They fired Jeff Soleko right after the season. We know that Seattle is open. They moved on from Andrew Allen right after the season, and boy, wouldn't it have been nice if they told the goalie coach before they told the media on that one. That should be a bit embarrassing for the franchise, but that's how it went down. And then Vegas as well, with Bruce Cassidy coming in. Mike Rosati's contract's expiring, and he was, you know, my understanding is he was just basically told that he would get a chance to interview with the new coach, but no promises beyond that. So there's four potential destinations there. I think there are some others that are going to open up in some cases based on, guys moving into those positions and creating, you know, vacancies elsewhere based on expiring contracts. For example, I believe this is a BC resident, lives on the island in the offseason, Kim Dillabaugh in Philly. I think his deal might be up, and there's been a lot of rumors tying him to Seattle because of the ties with Dave Hakstol, and a lot of people that believe Hakstol would like for him to be the next goalie coach with the Seattle Kraken, which would open up a spot in Philly. So, in other words, there's a lot of musical chairs in the goalie coaching department. As the head coaching jobs get sorted, that's usually what's next. Now, some teams leave it till the last minute. Some teams just don't treat the position. I've banged this drum before with enough respect. We've seen teams not even bother to start interviewing goalie coaches, let alone hire, and go through entire development camps without somebody there to run their goaltending department, which to me should be embarrassing, but, you know, too often that's the way it happens with NHL teams. That said, there are some that I think are already in the interview stage, and I would not be at all surprised. I've already heard Curtis Sanford's name sort of out there as a possibility. Obviously, he's got another year left on his deal here. Those teams would have to have permission to speak with him. But if you go back to sort of the way the team approached Brad Shaw when his name came up, well, you know, what did we hear from, I can't remember if it was Patrick Alvin or Jim Rutherford or where it was. It may have been with you guys or with Donnie and Dolly, but talking about how, like, we're not going to stand in the way of guys moving up into, bigger or better positions, as long as it's a promotion. And so I'm not sure whether, you know, access has been requested or permission granted to talk to Curtis, but I know he's a name. When you look at the success the Canucks have had with goalies and under the tutelage of Ian Clark and the job that Curtis Sanford did with Spencer Martin this year, I think there are a lot of teams that see some of the successes here and would like to find a way to piggyback that. And one of the quickest ways would be to hire a guy like Curtis Sanford. So, I think that is a real risk this summer, that they could lose him to an NHL opportunity elsewhere. We'll have to wait and see. It's still a little early. I don't have anything definitive there or any interviews or anything like that, but I certainly a name that I'm hearing connected to some of these jobs.
We're pretty much out of time, but can't let you go without a take on the Vezina voting. Igor Shesterkin, we knew he was going to run away with it, but Thatcher Demko gets 1/3 place vote. Did he get enough consideration from NHL GMs?
Yeah, no, I mean, at the end of the day, the top tier was the top tier, and I think his numbers got hurt. If they make the playoffs, this is a different conversation. And I think the process of trying to make the playoffs, there were some games down the stretch that kind of really hammered his numbers, and some of them were in a spotlight because of the playoff race that also hammered his chances of being in this conversation. And as we found out later, it's because he was playing through something, right? Because as soon as they were sort of officially out, you know, he had to shut it down. So, it's hard for me to critique the GMs, even if Markstrom over Saros is a bit of an atrocity. I don't know that I can rip them for not having Demko getting more votes, but he got the same number of votes as Tristan Jarry, which definitely left me scratching my head. And Ilya Sorokin was the best goalie, arguably, in the second half of the season in the NHL, and he's going to be in this conversation for a long time. But a little surprised to see him get a first, a second, and 3 third-place votes. on a team that also didn't make the playoffs. So I don't know that it matters, but I think he deserved probably a little more love than he got. And I think you would have seen that if not for, you know, those final couple weeks of the season that hurt both, you know, the perception, but also some of his raw numbers as he tried to, you know, play through something to help them get into the playoffs. You know, it's one of those ones where it's hard to critique where things ended up, and yet I still think he was worthy of at least a little more consideration even after that late drop.
Woodley, you're the best. Thanks for this.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Talk to you next week.
There is Kevin Woodley, goalie guru, here for us on Canuck Central. Quickly, bet on hockey like never before with Play Now Sports, your local BC sportsbook. Yep, it's a pick 'em tonight. $1.90 on the money line for either the Tampa Bay Lightning or the Colorado Avalanche. Game 4 is coming your way here on Sportsnet 650 coming up after 5 o'clock. Up next, overrated or underrated? Everybody's favorite Wednesday game is next on Canuck Central.